Welcome to the Civil War Center podcast. Learn about the battles, events, and people that shaped a turning point in American history. I'm your host, Andrew Lucian. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the podcast. Today we are joined by Colonel Ed Lowe. Colonel Lowe served for 26 years on active duty in the U.S. Army. He attended North Georgia College and has graduate degrees from California State University, the U.S. Army War College, U.S. Command and General Staff College, and Webster's University. He's an adjunct professor for the University of Maryland Global Campus and Elizabethtown College, where he teaches history and government. Ed is also the author of A Fine Opportunity Lost, Longstreet's East Tennessee Campaign, November 1863 to April 1864. Today we will talk about his book and learn about Longstreet's campaign into Eastern Tennessee in November of 1863. We'll learn about Ambrose Burnside and some of the major actions that took place there and how the campaign was ultimately a failure for the Confederacy. I hope you enjoy this discussion. All right, everybody. So today we are joined by author Ed Lowe. We're going to be discussing his book on the East Tennessee campaign. We'll be discussing James Longstreet, Ulysses Grant, Burnside. We'll talk about some different key strategic forts, Chickamauga, Chattanooga, a whole wealth of fun things out west. Ed, how are you doing today? Thank you for joining us.
I'm great. Thank you, Andrew, for having me on here.
Yeah, I'm very excited. I have read almost all of the book. I'll be finishing up after this interview. But I'd say I'm over three quarters of the way through it. It's fantastic. So listeners Right. should definitely read it.
Thank you.
That's a Savis Beatty published, which we have, we've had him on in the past. But tell us a little bit about yourself and kind of what got you into the Civil War and writing and all that.
Well, I spent 26 years in the Army, got commissioned out of North Georgia College in North Georgia, obviously in Dahlonega, Georgia, and you spent 26 years going around, different various forts, overseas deployments to war zones and all that, combat zones. And I retired in 2015. And my last military assignment was Carlisle, Pennsylvania. So that kind of lit the fire under me for the Civil War being so close to Gettysburg as it was. And so that, I really took to that and then came down here, retired in Chattanooga, and kind of fell in love with the Chickamauga and Chattanooga battlefields and, just strolling around there and learning as much as I can. And then noticing that, hey, James Longstreet was also here in the West, as well as obviously Gettysburg. So, I kind of put those two together and, pitched a book I did at Ted Savis, and we ran with it and, put together a kind of a first draft manuscript and, still kind of trudging through that, but Chris Makowski at Emerging Civil War pitched the idea of maybe doing a shorter ECW book on solely the East Tennessee campaign. And so I went off and running with that, and it got published last February. So that's kind of how that came about.
Awesome. So you weren't always fixated on the East Tennessee campaign. You were more Gettysburg, and then kind of that led you into East Tennessee.
Well, invariably, when I was looking at Longstreet's year-long, operations from Gettysburg down to Georgia and then up into Tennessee. Invariably, I'm going to end up in East Tennessee and Knoxville and beyond, closer to Bristol. And so all my research certainly included that aspect of his activity from November of 63 to April of 64, when he was reunited with the Army of Northern Virginia, and just in time for the Overland Campaign, the Battle of the Wilderness, where he's severely injured on May 6th and takes him out of action for a number of months.
So it's of interest to me because I'm a Western theater Civil War person, but for you, it's kind of just, Longstreet gets you out there. So tell us a little bit about, why does Longstreet head out west? Why does Lee send him out there? Mm-hmm. Kind of set up maybe some of the strategic situation out there for our listeners.
I think for the strategic and operational level, Longstreet had been pushing a movement, a chance to go out west, even before Gettysburg. And after Gettysburg in July of 63, pitches the idea again, Lee concurs. Jeff Davis agrees, and he heads south in early September, second week of September, with two divisions. John Bell Hood does accompany the force down to Georgia, even though he was recovering from his wound from Gettysburg, of course. But they talked him into accompanying the Longstreet's men down south. So he's commanding his division, of course, in Lafayette McLaws. And they end up down in, for the most part, the majority of the forces there joined Braxton Bragg's Army of Tennessee for the Battle of Chickamauga, which took place September 18, 19, the 20th. And of course, on the 20th, John Bell Hood is wounded once again. Evander Law, who had taken over Hood's division at Gettysburg, then assumes command of the division. But shortly after the Battle of Chickamauga, individual named Micah Jenkins comes down and really takes command of Hood's division. He had a his date of rank was a couple months earlier than Law, but that would be who would command Hood's division would be a boil that would fester for months. Unfortunately, I think it was part of the friction that was in Longstreet's command and those two divisions, but he goes into the partial siege operations of Chattanooga in early October, end of September, early October. U.S. Grant comes west, of course, to Chattanooga, but the command climate within Braxton Bragg's Army of Tennessee was not that favorable, and Longstreet, as well as some of his other generals, had petitioned authorities in Richmond that Braxton Bragg needed to go. So much so that on April 9th, Davis arrives in Chattanooga to discuss the command situation within Bragg's army, stays for a few days. And at the end of the day, Bragg is left in command. So, but Longstreet had been one of the more vocal critics, I guess, of Braxton Bragg during this period. In fact, one of Bragg's staff officers said that Longstreet did more damage than all the other general officers combined. And so when Grant had comes to Chattanooga, he replaces William Rosecrans, commander of the Army of the Cumberland, with George Thomas. And then they conduct a when Thomas gets when Grant gets on board, and here in Chattanooga, they develop an operation that Rosecrans had really started, the capture of Brown's Ferry on October 27th. That kind of opened up the supply line, would eventually. And then we have the night action at the Battle of Wauhatchie, 29th of October, which does not go well. Does not go well. And it's during that period that Jeff Davis writes a message to Braxton Bragg. Why don't you send Longstreet up to tackle Ambrose Burnside's Army of the Ohio, which is loitering around Knoxville, south of Knoxville area? And so Bragg sends Longstreet off with his command, his two divisions. Joe Wheeler's cavalry with four brigades, totaling roughly about 15 to 17,000 troops altogether, and they head out in early November, and that's kind of how that all shaped what would be the East Tennessee campaign, and which really the preponderance of the book really covers really from Chattanooga on up until they reunite with Lee in April.
So Longstreet goes out west. He's kind of fixating on Burnside, and that's what's launching this campaign, right? So tell us a little bit about, just again, so listeners know, Battle
Sure.
of Chattanooga. Grant obviously beats Bragg. And tell us kind of about a little more about the falling out between Bragg and how Longstreet ends up getting sent away and ends up really focusing on Burnside.
Yeah. Well, there is a, I guess there is some who think that, when Longstreet left in early November, that it was an independent command. And that really wasn't the case, not until December 10th is he given kind of departmental level command in East Tennessee. But when he departed, when Longstreet departed Chattanooga, Bragg is very clear on his intent, commander's intent, basically saying rapid blows is what he tells Longstreet to do with regard to Burnside. Make it quick, because he says I may have to recall you in case of an emergency. And so this is kind of a string that Bragg has on Longstreet, and I think justifiably so, with Grant's forces, getting stronger and stronger every day, especially in November. Sherman's heading in that direction as well. So, it's a very challenging period. Even U.S. Grant says, sending Longstreet away was probably not a wise tactical and operational decision, given Longstreet's reputation in the East under Lee. But I think this is a reflection of what I try and convey in the book is, personalities matter, and people are not infallible. They have their emotions, they have their biases, et cetera, and that certainly, was demonstrated from November on, throughout Longstreet's time in East Tennessee. The frustrations of command that he had, not only with Bragg, but also some of his subordinates before and after the Fort Sanders attack at the end of November of 63. So much so that Longstreet even submits his resignation at the end of December. Thinks another commander should be tried. And so I think, again, that this highlights, even senior level commanders in either the U.S. or the Confederacy, that is challenging. And it's they say command can be lonely at times, and that was certainly the case.
That makes sense. And especially coming east, right, where he's kind of like, he's Lee's old war horse. So and now he's out dealing with Braxton Bragg, who I've never spared any nice words to say about him on this show. So we don't have to start now. But all right. So Bragg, I'm sorry. So Longstreet goes off now. He's making his move on East Tennessee. Tell us a little bit about the start of this campaign, his movements, Burnside, and how this action is beginning in East Tennessee.
Not a good start. He leaves out of Chattanooga. The trains, you have really the train network. You had the East Tennessee and Georgia Railroad, and at Knoxville you had the East Tennessee and Virginia Railroad. And so really that railroad was really critical to connecting east, west, west, and east theaters of war. So very operationally, strategically important. I think another note is East Tennessee was often pro-Union. Had a lot of, Bushwick, he was going into country with a lot of East Tennessee Unionists that probably would not look favorably upon his force. In fact, when Burnside enters Knoxville in early September, he's greeted almost as a liberator. There's a famous Harper's Weekly drawing of showing him coming into Knoxville. And so you had that going against him, but also the supply situation. The trains going out of Knoxville, Moxley Sorrell, who was on Longstreet's staff, called them almost comical in their inefficiency. Going up to Sweetwater, which is about some miles south of Knoxville, and really following the railroad, Longstreet didn't have any supplies. When he left Virginia in early September, basically, the soldiers carried what brought with them what they could carry on their back. They were really deficient in wagons, and other really what all the other equipment that is really needed to really push for an aggressive command operation. And so he was lacking in that. When he goes up to Sweetwater, there is a Confederate general there named Carter Stevenson, and to Longstreet's dismay and astonishment, all the foraging and supplies that Carter Stevenson had gathered were directed to be sent down to Chattanooga. And so the entire area is really doesn't have a lot of promise for feeding his men or his animals. And he and Bragg get into a tussle over messaging in the second week of November, where Longstreet's complaining about the lack of support, and Bragg won't have any of it, and basically says it's you're in command, that's your job. Longstreet would write in his memoirs that it began to look more like a campaign against Longstreet than Burnside. And so it didn't get off to a good start, a very rocky start, especially with what he was dealing with the Army of Tennessee and supply issues. So, but he's going forward, crosses the Loudoun River, or not the Loudoun River, but the Tennessee River at Loudoun. Does that begins crossing at about on November 14th. And Burnside had come south from Knoxville, and being in the service as I was, conducting a major river crossing operation can be very challenging, very complex. And Burnside's men are really telling him, the commander, hey, why don't we just put up a stout defense along the river's edge so they can't cross? But Burnside's doesn't agree with that. He and Grant had been in communication, and they both agree that the best thing that Burnside could do at this juncture is to really pull Longstreet along closer to Knoxville and further away from Chattanooga. And that is essentially what, from an operational plan, that's essentially what Burnside does. The bridge at Loudoun had been destroyed. Now, when the Confederates left, he had a guy named Simon Buckner, who was up in Knoxville, and he had headed south to join Braxton Bragg's Army of Tennessee before Chickamauga. So that bridge is no longer an option. Longstreet's plan to gain Knoxville was really to cross the river and approach Knoxville from the south, where we have now the forts south of the Tennessee River now. But he didn't have, he did he had the pontoons, but he didn't have the wagons to be able to pull his pontoons. So he crosses a place called Huff's Ferry, and he will have to approach Knoxville really from that direction, not across any rivers or anything of that nature. And he had always wanted to bring Burnside to battle. That's how he operated in the West. That's how Lee operated. Get him out, let's have an open battle. And that's what he was trying to do with Burnside. He has a battle at Campbell Station 2 days after crossing the Tennessee River at Loudoun. But again, Burnside does a delaying action, goes from one point to another, where really it's mostly an artillery action, I guess, artillery battle. And Longstreet would actually compliment Burnside, saying that was a retreat that was very cleverly conducted. But we also have an episode at Campbell Station where Evander Law is accused of not doing what he was supposed to have done, told by Micah Jenkins to try and find the flank, and instead that doesn't go well, and both Micah Jenkins and Longstreet will blame Law for the failure at Campbell Station, just as they had blamed Law for the Battle of Wauhatchie. He had pulled out too soon, and so things aren't looking good for Evander Law, and Longstreet has already has his eyes on him. To Longstreet, Evander Law has not performed like he needed to, and he has two strikes against him. And so they arrive up in Knoxville area around the 17th and 18th of November. Longstreet puts, I guess we could call it, a partial siege. And I think this is, I think I write it in a book, probably one of the biggest tactical and operational mistakes that Longstreet made in his entire East Tennessee command was not knowing the river networks in and around Knoxville. Because what he fails to realize, and granted, he was not given a lot of support from Bragg when he left, as far as maps and people who knew the area, et cetera. But he was confused on, again, especially the Holston River and the French Broad. Now, the Holston River was really the Tennessee River today. It was not, the Holston was changed in 1933 to the Tennessee River, where the confluence of the French Broad and the Holston River, that's where the Tennessee River begins now. But back then it was the Holston River, and Longstreet was unaware or felt that the French Broad River was much further south. And so for that reason, and very influential and really, Confederate sympathizers had told Longstreet that you do not have Burnside encircled because you are missing the French Broad, and all they have to do is float down supplies on flatboats, et cetera, and rafts, and Burnside can pluck them out of the river. long as she would hear nothing of it. One, two, three individuals tell him, "Sir, you're not understanding the rivers here." But long as she say, "I trust my maps. I trust my maps," and that's it. And of course, invariably, Burnside is able to gain supplies from some of the unionist, pro-unionist counties, around Knoxville that do just that. They float supplies down. So again, like I've said, I think that was a huge mistake. And in the military, we call that human intelligence, which is often very critical and for the most part, often reliable. And so he settles down for a siege. And there were a number of Burnside had roughly, at the start of this campaign, about 23,000 soldiers, but these guys were spread out all the way from Cumberland Gap all the way down to Loudoun, Tennessee. So very, very dispersed. And in and around Burnside at the time of this operation, middle end November, he has roughly about 12,000 men, 51 cannons. Edward Porter Alexander, famous from Gettysburg as well, Pickett's Charge, he has 34 guns. And so they Longstreet begins placing his commands around Knoxville. Alexander is placing his cannons as well. And this begins. And I think the second part that we see here, I think the frustration not only amongst Longstreet's subordinate commanders, but also some of the Confederate civilians inside Knoxville, which there were a number, alongside their pro-Unionist citizens. So that, they were in the town there. But, Longstreet's reputation in the East obviously was, every I is dotted, every T is crossed. Let's make sure we are ready. And delay after delay takes place. Longstreet had asked Bragg for reinforcements. And at the end, he ends up getting 2,500 soldiers, Bushrod Johnson, Archibald Gracie, coming to the area. But that takes a few days. That takes some time with the railroad network I had mentioned. And so Longstreet delays the final attack, I guess. They had initially spotted Fort Sanders as maybe probably the best place to attack. It was a salient fort on the west side, kind of protruded out like a salient does. And Alexander, with his guns and configured mortars, he was just rubbing his hands. He said, "This is you know, I can concentrate all my fire on this small little salient here, the small fort." That wasn't commanded by very many soldiers. Unfortunately, when you go visit Knoxville, it's all been eaten up by the University of Tennessee. And so, but the topography, I think, is still there. You can still get a good sense of what at least the land looked like, how the soldiers would have to have approached the fort from a couple of directions. So Longstreet and his commanders, they look at Fort Sanders and say, "This is the one. Okay, we're gonna start. We'll attack this place," and they begin preparations for that. Alexander had taken a battery, a Virginia battery, across the river to the Cherokee Heights that would provide some long distance fire onto Fort Sanders. But then Danville Ledbetter, who was Bragg's chief of engineer, arrives in Knoxville on the 25th of September, or November rather. And Ledbetter was very influential, of course. He's Bragg's chief engineer. And he doesn't really think that Fort Sanders is the best place for an assault to be tried. And they reconnoitre and they see on the east side a place called Mabry Hill. And Ledbetter was very, very familiar with the Knoxville defenses. He was there very impactful as far as these defenses when they were beginning to get organized and established. So he turns his gaze to Mabry Hill on the east, and Alexander pulls the Virginia battery off of Cherokee Heights. He reconfigures his artillery. Then that doesn't occur. That doesn't take place. They change their mind once again. Longstreet and his commanders are going back towards looking at Fort Sanders, and the officers there see a U.S. soldier walking across the ditch that was there. Yeah. Longstreet says, this is not going to be much of an obstacle at all. It maybe comes up to his knees, you know, or something. Unbeknownst to them, and maybe they probably should have realized that, it was the soldiers walking on a plank. And so, you know, Longstreet, to Longstreet's mind, that ditch and the obstacles there before Fort Sanders will not be too much of a challenge for his command. As far as Fort Sanders itself, you're configured like a normal, you know, fort is. The Burnside's primary engineer in this was a guy named Orlando Poe, and he had put the fences together, and he had come across, for example, they had cut down all the trees, of course, around Fort Sanders, like you'd always see, you know, maybe a foot and a half stump is left, and one of the a gentleman at the railroad depot gave him miles and miles of telegraph wire to wrap around the tree stumps, which is what he does. They have, I think, I want to say they have 12 guns. Yeah, they have 12 guns at Fort Sanders. You know, enfilading, you know, providing enfilading fire. You know, great range as far as your configuration, as far as where they're aiming and et cetera. So it, you know, they were ready. And it's commanded by the artillery commander's guy named Lieutenant Benjamin. He is the commander there of the artillery there at Fort Sanders. And so the 28th, they're planning this assault on Fort Sanders. It rains, and so we have another delay. Bushrod Johnson and Archibald Gracie had come up from Chattanooga. So Longstreet thinks he's ready. And so, unfortunately, for Longstreet or for Alexander as well, Longstreet changes the plan. It's not going to really consist of a massive artillery bombardment by Alexander's 34 guns. Instead, it's going to be a pre-dawn assault on Sunday, November 29th, with very little artillery fire on the fort itself. Surprise would be key. Alexander said he was incredulous with that decision because he knew the impact that his guns could have on Fort Sanders. Instead, he is simply to fire a few rounds, and you know that would be the signal for the infantry to begin their assault. And the night before, Micah Jenkins, very concerned about, you know, Fort Sanders and the ditch in front of the fort itself, goes to Lafayette McLaws expressing his fear and concerns about the assault. Lafayette McLaws basically says, you know, we have to just have faith and trust, and you know, don't listen to our fears, and we'll be successful. Micah Jenkins then goes to Porter Alexander, who is very tired from having to shift his artillery around from Maberhill back to Fort Sanders, and gives him a nod. And you know, Alexander's away, suggests maybe you write Longstreet a letter, which he does. And Longstreet replies, basically echoing what Lafayette McLaws says, you know, if we go in with, basically, to paraphrase, if we go in with the intent to fail, then we will do so. But men who are determined and courageous, you know, that determined cannot fail. And so that's kind of what the situation was. And at 2300 hours on the 28th, you know, they had assembled their forces in assembly areas, attack positions, and they began to push off the, I guess, the skirmishers and the rifle pits in front of the fort that the U.S. soldiers were occupying. But that does one thing. It tells Burnside and the commanders the assault is fixing to begin because of the heavy rifle fire that was taking place. And at about 3 o'clock, 3:30 in the morning, the rest of the remaining soldiers, about 6,000, 41% of Longstreet's infantry, assemble and get ready for the assault. And you certainly can't dismiss, and certainly was a factor, was how cold it was. There's one soldier, I think from the 21st Mississippi, talks about looking down the line of soldiers and teeth rattling, knees shaking because it was so cold. And at 6:30, they begin the assault. And As Micah Jenkins had predicted, soldiers crossed the fields fairly well. Longstreet's directions was that they were not to fire until they were got into the ditch or got up on the parapets, et cetera, and began to enter the fort, because he wanted that one round to really count. And so they moved forward. The wire obstacles really do not hinder the advancement too much. But how they had arranged, developed the land as far as outside Fort Sanders, the Federals had kind of furrows, I guess, that kind of funneled the Confederate attack into just a few narrow lanes. And so there are testimonies from Confederate commanders that their commands were getting bunched up and, interspersed within each other. But they make it past the wire entanglements with really no problem at all, and then they get to the ditch. And we're talking 6 to 8 feet deep, and then with the walls, and I mean, we're talking 15 to 20 feet high is how far they would have to reach. And they had no ladder. They had no ladders. And that was Micah Jenkins's big concern the night before. We have no fascines, we have no ladders, have really no way to get up, over the walls of the fort. And sadly, they find that out in a very, very hard and difficult way. They're stuck in the ditch. Their testimony after testimony, report after report by the U.S. soldiers of they didn't even have to take fire or aim their fire. They just had to shoot, and it would find a quote death mark. Artillery, the canister rounds that are fought. Lieutenant Benjamin had put together 50 cannon shells with very short fuses. He would use as hand grenades and just lob them over the parapet walls and the ditch, and explosions would obviously occur. And Federal soldiers talked about the hearing of the screams, the shrieking, and of the wounded. 30 minutes is over. That's it. 813 casualties for Longstreet. 129 killed. Best U.S. estimates, there were 13. 13 casualties among the U.S. forces, Air Force, Army. Talk about a disparity. Really, really remarkable. Longstreet calls the assault off. One of his A trusted staff officer from Lafayette McLaws just goes to him, Major Thomas Gogan, I believe, tells Longstreet that another assault would be futile. And so Longstreet does not authorize a second assault. In fact, he pulls units back, and even while some were urging that a second assault would win the day. And Longstreet, I think, would later in his memoirs and official reports talk about how he wished he had probably done another assault. But as he said, I think in his memoirs, he said the confidence in war had been lost. Words to that effect. Roughly about that same time, Longstreet gets wind that William T. Sherman is heading up in his direction with 30,000 soldiers. Chattanooga had fallen by that time. The last battle of Chattanooga was on the 25th of November. And so you see this operational picture, the impact that it's having across the region. Chattanooga has fallen. The Army of Tennessee has fled to Dalton, Georgia. And of course, President Lincoln had always reminded U.S. Grant, remember Burnside. Grant would echo that in his memoirs that so often Lincoln would send that reminder to him. And so as a result of that prodding by Lincoln, he sends Gordon Granger's Fourth Corps along with William T. Sherman's large force, and they make their way to Knoxville. And in early December, he holds a council of war with his commanders and said, basically says, initially, there were reports, messengers that arrived at Longstreet's headquarters after Fort Sanders that Bragg wants you to rejoin him in Dalton. But with the mountainous terrain, the really lack of really capable wagons and supplies to be able to move such a larger force, that really became impracticable. And so basically, Longstreet's only option was to head further into East Tennessee, which he does on December 4th. He quietly vacates his positions in and around Knoxville, and he heads further and further into East Tennessee and beyond, or Knoxville and beyond. Have a couple other battles there in East Tennessee, the Battle of Bean Station. We have Mossy Creek, we have Dandridge, in December and January. I'd mentioned that in early that Joe Wheeler had four brigades of cavalry, and Wheeler had actually gone had left a Longstreet's command in I think it was November 23rd. He departs for Bragg's headquarters, and really as we get into the cold days of January and February, slowly the cavalry commands under Longstreet are taken away and sent down to join Bragg's Army of Tennessee. So his cavalry screen is gone, or begins to matriculate south, and it becomes less and less. And he has no choice at the end of November, or end of February rather, 64, to make his way to Greenville, Tennessee, which was the home of Andrew Johnson, for really his final headquarters. And he's there for a number of months. And then in early April, he gets a message to rejoin Lee's Army of Northern Virginia. And a lot of soldiers, officers, and non-commissioned officers talk about they gleefully welcome that that reunion with Lee's Army. East Tennessee has been their nightmare. With supply challenges, and a lot of the commanders that you read about in Gettysburg or Chickamauga, three in particular, Jerome Robertson, who led the Texas Brigade, Lafayette McLaws, and Evander Law, when in the summer of 64, all those officers are gone from the Army of Tennessee because of Evander Law, for instance. In December, on December 17th, he submits his resignation to Longstreet. Says he wants to join the cavalry, the Confederate cavalry. Longstreet acquiesces, agrees for Law to take his resignation personally to Richmond to submit it. Long story short, here Longstreet thinks that Law has deceived him, that he had some ill intentions, ill will to go into Richmond in the first place, and has him arrested. A court martial ensues. And I'll talk about that with Lafayette McLaws. And Lafayette McLaws is court martial as well, relieved of command on the same day as Lafayette, as Evander Law, when he submitted for the operation at Fort Sanders for charges against. And the one that stuck during the court martial was the failure to provide, this is McLaws, his failure to provide any means to overcome the obstacles that were there at Fort Sanders. And Jerome Robertson, he had been disgruntled about the entire campaign since leaving Chattanooga. Micah Jenkins had enough of him. At the end of the day, with these court martials, Richmond is fed up with it. At the end of the day, Evander Law is gone. He's wounded at Cold Harbor in June of 64, and he ends the war under Joe Johnston, having gained his wish to join the cavalry. And Lafayette McLaws, the same way, he's gone in May of 64 to the defenses around Georgia and the Carolinas. He's out. And Jerome Robertson, there are actually no written record. There's no written record of the proceedings against him, but he's gone. He goes back to Texas to kind of organize and command the Texas reserves in that state. But with everything that happened in December, and certainly end of November, and like I mentioned previously, Longstreet, so flustered, command is lonely indeed, and he submits his resignation, which is not accepted, of course. But when they hold a big reunion of the Army of Northern Virginia with Longstreet's men at the end of November, end of April of 64, a big event. Soldiers talk about how it took hours to do the passing review, and great to see Longstreet and Lee joy, smiling, chatting, very joyful. But again, we see the start of the overland campaign in the wilderness, I guess less than a week later. And that's kind of summation, I guess, of Longstreet's East Tennessee campaign right there.
And it sounds like something that you probably are aware of, being from military history and having, I mean, being from a military background and having studied this, something normal people might not realize is the importance of, supply lines, political sides of, you have political generals and you have people promoted for this reason and people fighting, Bragg's fighting with, they're trying to get rid of him and all this infighting and structural problems, infrastructure problems with railroads, right? The importance of that, is that kind of a huge reason that this campaign is such a disaster?
And I think you have to, I think you're spot on. I think you have to look at all that. The foraging but beyond Knoxville and going towards Bristol, actually, soldiers talk about it was rather plush. They had good foraging opportunities, as well as those who were U.S. forces who were kind of pursuing Knoxville at that point, kind of a jockey and a back and forth on the good foraging lands east of Knoxville. But the weather was bitter cold. And again, go back to what I mentioned earlier, that a lot of these soldiers, they had left Virginia with what they just carry on their back. And so cold weather clothing is a challenge. A lot of these soldiers do not have shoes, do not have, boots, proper footwear. And account after account of, as they're withdrawing out of Knoxville on these very slippery and icy roads, of looking back and just seeing bloody footprints all across the way. It's probably the norm. That's probably what is typical. They open a couple of tanneries and they begin to develop, put together footwear that they call Longstreet's moccasins. That's what they call them, to kind of mitigate the footwear challenge. But cold weather gear, cold weather. Proper attire there, clothing is very much in want from most of Longstreet's soldiers, commanders, and that does influence certainly in all the other aspects you mentioned as well, the politicalization that had festered into the command itself, the Army of Tennessee and Longstreet's command as well, the command challenges, supply. And certainly can't discount the bushwhackers and the pro-unionists that, like in East Tennessee, you really didn't have that problem. You didn't have pro-unionists outside the lines, and you're competing with them for food stuff and everything, and having to watch soldiers having to watch their flanks when they're going out to get food and forage and everything. The pro-unionists will take a shot at them. Same with bushwhackers. And of course, you mentioned the railroad challenges. East Tennessee and Virginia Railroad was a little better, and that became operational at a point, and slowly, the supplies began to roll in. But it's at that same time that the cavalry elements under Longstreet's command get pulled, like I mentioned. And without cavalry, you don't have those are the eyes and ears. We see that throughout the Civil War, and once those elements begin to get pulled, Longstreet really has no other choice but to go further and further into East Tennessee, Greenville, and then, towards Bristol, Virginia, and beyond.
And what's sort of the overall impact of this campaign? We talked a little bit about, what happens in East Tennessee. Well, quite a bit about what happens in East Tennessee, a little bit about, Longstreet heading back west or back east. But what's the impact overall, in terms of the war as a whole?
I think U.S. Grant says it in his memoirs, and I'm going to paraphrase here. Grant was never a big fan or never could understand why Bragg even let Longstreet go. Of course, Grant and Longstreet knew each other before the war. They were friends. And Grant mentions it.
Longstreet was at his wedding, correct?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Grant kind of talks about his memoirs that if Longstreet had been in Chattanooga, Or maybe he had defeated Burnside, say, at Campbell Station on November 16th. Yeah, I don't want to go into counterfactual history here, but Grant would say, or did say, that he would have been lucky to have gotten out of Chattanooga alive. I think that's how much weight he put on Longstreet as a commander, and certainly his veteran soldiers. And so then you get into, if Chattanooga does remain in Confederate hands, what happens to Grant's star in the eyes of Lincoln? Does it dim somewhat if he does lose Chattanooga? If that happens, and Grant's big strategy, when he takes over as general in chief, does that even get developed? And does Sherman make his way to Atlanta and, taking Atlanta in September 64? And if Chattanooga is still in Confederate hands, if Sherman can't do that, and if that doesn't happen, does Lincoln get reelected? And so, there's always that, ripple effect. And I think that demonstrates the importance of both Chattanooga and the Knoxville campaign that had two, so impactful for the South, but also very impactful for the U.S. operational and strategic plans that they would have going forward, how critical that was. Chattanooga was the gateway of the Deep South, the drive to Atlanta, the Sherman's march to the sea, et cetera. So, absolutely, absolutely critical. But again, that's kind of why I wrote that book, and I think why Ted Savvas and Chris Makowski wanted me to write it, because there's not a lot written about, the East Tennessee campaign. Earl Hess did write a great book on the not these th this campaign itself. Very highly recommended. I think that just demonstrates how critical it was to both the North and the South.
Yeah, that's for some reason there's like Gettysburg and Vicksburg and all in the Overland campaign. We pay so much attention to these, and sometimes we overlook these battles that are even arguably strategically more important, right? And they get overlooked for whatever reason. No, that's fascinating. I highly recommend listeners to read your book to make sure they pick it up. How can listeners support you, support your work, connect with you if they want to?
I guess the book in and of itself will certainly do that. If you want to, my contact information, if you want to put that out there, that's fine. Email or something if they want to, they have any, maybe your listeners have any other follow-up questions that maybe I didn't address. I'll be happy to engage and talk about this. Maybe learn something new myself. That's what I always love, and talking to folks of like yourself and those who love the Civil War, always learning, gathering it from, gathering information that maybe you didn't know about. And so always eager to learn and listening to people and their perspectives and views, because that does matter, and it does, shape my views as well, and kind of going forward. So yeah.
Do you have any plans to write any more?
Well, funny you mention that. There's a guy named Robert Carter, who's been a guide at Chickamauga for, God, 25 years. He and I are good friends, and he and I are working on a book on the Great Locomotive Chase, April 12th, 1862. About Ohio soldiers and a couple of civilians go down to Atlanta and steal the general, and try and burn some of the key bridges and on the Western Atlantic Railroad, but that fails. And the book will certainly address why that did fail, why it didn't wasn't very wasn't didn't occur like they wanted it to, didn't end like they wanted it to. But they're all captured, in long story short, and eight of them are executed in Atlanta in June of 62. And the first Medal of Honor winners go to these guys. And so, if when I give tours at Chattanooga, one of my stops is at Chattanooga National Cemetery, because when you enter the cemetery, you can't help but notice a big monument with a locomotive on top of it. And that is the general, because the eight who were executed are buried at Chattanooga National Cemetery. And you can, pay your respect, go there, pay your respects to them. And Joe Biden presented the last two of the writers who did not receive the Medal of Honor in I think it was July of 2024. The final two do receive the Medal of Honor. So, yeah, that's what I'm working on now. I hope to. We had a Chris Mikowski said it's probably that book is scheduled for publication in the spring of 2027. So, but we're about wrapping it up. We're putting the finishing touches on it, and then it'll go through the editorial process.
So it sounds like you'll be back on the show.
That'd be great. I
Excited
would
about
love it.
that.
I would love it. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate your time. This has been a great discussion.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Civil War Center podcast. Please like, share, subscribe, and leave a review as it helps the podcast grow. And we'll see you next week.